Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 62 and cloudy. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hi, this is Virginia, and this is the Harper's Magazine articles for April 27th, starting with the weekly review. Derek Chauvin was found guilty of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter of George Floyd, and at least six people were killed in the United States by police officers in the 24 hours following the conviction. Days before Philadelphia's first official day of remembrance for the 1985 police bombing of the MOVE organization, it was revealed that the bones of black children murdered in the siege had been used without permission for an online course titled Real Bones, Adventures in Forensic Anthropology. In Des Moines, Iowa, a woman who ran over two children with her 1998 Jeep Grand Cherokee because of their ethnicities pleaded guilty to two counts of attempted murder. And in Oklahoma, Governor Kevin Stint signed a bill that protects drivers who runs over protesters. I remain unequivocally committed to protecting every Oklahoman's First Amendment right to peacefully protest, as well as the right to feel safe in their community, Stint said. A bill to combat anti-Asian hate crimes passed in the Senate 94-1. The single nay vote came from Senator Josh Hawley, who tweeted that it turns the federal government into a speech police. President Biden officially acknowledged the Armenian genocide, and a White House official said that the United States, whose current and previous presidential administrations have both asserted that there is an ongoing genocide of Uyghur Muslims, will pressure China at the G7 meeting in June about its use for forced labor in Xinjiang. Is it enough? No, said John Kerry, Biden's special envoy for climate, on the president's commitment to halve U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. In India, which is currently facing the largest COVID-19 surge on record, a thief returned a bag stolen from a hospital after realizing that it contained vaccine vials, attaching an apology note that said, "Sorry, didn't know these were COVID vaccines." And in Cantizzaro, Italy, a civil servant assigned to a hospital was accused of collecting his full salary, despite skipping work since 2005. Before it was announced that he would host an upcoming episode of Saturday Night Live, Elon Musk tweeted, "Autopilot was not enabled," in response to news reports that a Tesla Model S car had crashed, killing two people, that an initial investigation of the wreck suggested that the driver's seat was vacant at the time of impact. After SpaceX and NASA successfully launched the spacecraft Crew Dragon Endeavour, its crew was warned of a possible collision with a flying object that, according to NASA, was classified as unknown before arriving safely at the International Space Station, which no longer has enough beds for all the astronauts on board. A new study by MIT found that in settings with mixed air, even masked individuals who spend significant time in such a space are as likely to contract COVID-19 as unmasked people, whether they are 6 or 60 feet apart. And a NASA executive pleaded guilty to using pandemic relief loans to pay off his Disney Vacation Club membership fees. Reflecting on his time in the White House, Donald Trump told fellow Palm Beach billionaire Roe resident Sean Hannity that what he misses most is helping people. George W. Bush, who withdrew from the United States, withdrew the United States from the Rome Statute and therefore shielded Americans from prosecution in the International Criminal Court, said that he wrote in the name of Condoleezza Rice when he voted in the 2020 presidential election. A renowned Tyrannosaurus expert studying a mass death site said that the synchronous death event suggests that these dinosaurs, formerly thought to have been solitary, may in fact have been capable of interacting as gregarious packs. American honey made in the recent past was found to contain radioactive fallout from nuclear weapons tested in the 50s and 60s. A rioter who bragged about his illegal actions at the U.S. Capitol to someone he chatted with on the dating app Bumble was arrested after his match provided screenshots of their conversation to law enforcement. A man in Japan was arrested for defrauding at least 35 women he was dating after he received birthday gifts valued at 100,000 yen, and a Taiwanese couple got married four times and divorced three times over a period of 37 days in order to take advantage of the country's eight-day paid marriage leave. A psychologist at a Minnesota sex offender treatment center was charged with sexually assaulting two of her patients. A British teacher who brought students to a strip club while intoxicated was banned from teaching for 3 years. And a French mayor, was convicted of rape, received criticism from feminist groups for continuing to run the town from his prison cell. President Jair Bolsonaro offered to reduce Brazil's deforestation of the Amazon by 40% in exchange for $1 billion from the Biden administration. And two fishermen who recovered a buoy owned by the U.S. government asked for $13,000 in exchange for its return. "If you lose something in the ocean, it doesn't stay yours forever," said their attorney, who is also the father of one of the fishermen. "It becomes salvaged." Publisher's note, In Memoriam, John Cullen, by John R. MacArthur on April 23, 2021. Readers may be wondering why I haven't posted a new translated column in the past 2 weeks, since I write monthly, almost without fail, for La Devoir of Montreal. There are two reasons. The first is that Catholic Quebec shuts down the day after Easter, so my column was delayed a week from its usual first of the Monday of the month publication schedule. And the second is during the delay, my friend and translator, John Cullen, fell ill and died. John's passing at 79 is a terrible loss for his partner, the novelist Valerie Martin, and for his family and friends back in New Orleans, where he was born. If you knew him, you would instantly recognize the easy and ironic humor of John's hometown in every story, in every joke he ever told. Raconteur is one of those French words that has gravitated seamlessly into English, and it describes John to a T. Like the city that bred him, he was never boring, and like the people he grew up with, he almost always took sufficient time to tell a story with style and aplomb. New Orleans is America's most unusual and, in some respects, most foreign city, with a culture that defies American stereotypes. I suspect that it's the melange of New Orleans French, Creole, Spanish, and English that turned John into a linguist, and it was his ease in commuting between cultures made him such a good translator. That facility, with varied tongues and nationalities, is no doubt what made him valuable to novelists and journalists alike. You might ask why I had my column translated at all, why I didn't just rewrite it myself in English. The answer is partly because I don't have the time or the patience, and partly because I think so separately in two languages because my mother was French and my father was American. But there's another very specific reason. In 2014, when I stopped writing my column in the Providence Journal, I suddenly had no regular outlet in English for the first time in many years. The easiest solution was to have my French column translated, and I thought, wouldn't that be a novelty? But I also never read French in translation, so I didn't know any translators or even how to judge them. Then I remembered John Cullen. I hadn't met him, but I knew one of his star clients, the novelist Philippe Claudel, from having moderated a discussion between Claudel and A.M. Holmes at NYU's Maison Française back in 2011. It was there that the actor Robert Adrian read an excerpt of Claudel's extraordinary work, Le Rapport de Brodrick, and it struck me, this is how Claudel should sound in English. It was pitch perfect. My American mind heard my French understanding of the novel and read it back to me so well in English that I hardly noticed the difference in languages. Later I learned that John occasionally translated Francophone journalists like Kamel Daoud, whose pieces on the op-ed page of the New York Times betrayed none of the standard awkwardness from foreign contributors. Lost in translation is a well-worn cliché, but it's axiomally true that meaning gets dispersed and hidden from one culture to another, one set of idioms to another. When I asked John if he would translate my column, at first he demurred. But then he finally agreed, and as of February 2016 until this past March, for 53 columns, John explained my French conception to my American readers. With considerable editing help from Harper Magazine, then-editor Ellen Rosenbusch, we turned it into something resembling my voice. Sometimes it worked perfectly, and Ellen, who continues to edit this column, changed almost nothing. Sometimes we struggled, but on those occasions had more to do with my French construction failing me than with John failing me. Now that he's gone, I will have a hard time finding a replacement. And I know that while I miss him very much as a person, I'm also missing something inside my head, and I don't quite know where to look for it. Is it in French or is it in English? I may have to go to New Orleans to find out. Report. Sign of the Times by James Harkin. Caliphate and the Perils of Reporting Online. In Chapter 5 of Caliphate, the now-debunked podcast from the New York Times, a young Canadian named Shajori Chowdhury explains how he came to stab a man in the heart on behalf of the Islamic State. Back in 2014, Chowdhury, who went by the nom de guerre Abu Hazafase, allegedly emptied his bank account and traveled to Syria to join the Islamic State, which assigned him to a police unit tasked with enforcing its strict interpretations of Sharia law. Over the next 6 months, he told the Times, he killed two people on behalf of the group. Eventually, he became disillusioned and returned to Canada. The interview was recorded in a Toronto hotel room in November 2016. Asking questions in a mellifluous staccato was Maminki Kalamachi, the paper's resident expert on the Islamic State. When Caliphate aired in 2018, it was a roaring success, drawing millions of listeners, many of whom have never read a Times article about Syria or Islamist terrorism. The project synced perfectly with the mission of the paper's executive director, Dean Basquet, and its CEO, Mark Thompson, to refresh the Grey Lady for a new multimedia age. And it contained startling revelations that led to righteous indignation in the Canadian Parliament and media. How was it possible that a terrorist had been allowed to return to a normal life in Canada after committing murders? Shortly after Chapter 4 aired, however, Chowdhury gave an interview to a Canadian journalist, Naseem Basque, in which he walked back some of his claims. He told Basque that he never executed anyone. Around the same time, he was also taken in for questioning by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Chowdhury had already been on their radar, but the outcry that followed his appearance on Caliphate likely triggered the investigation. The RCMP found no evidence that Chowdhury had traveled to Syria. In September 2020, he was charged with perpetrating a terrorist hoax. After initially defending its report, the Times launched an internal investigation, which confirmed in December that Chowdhury had almost certainly never been to Syria. The paper published a mea culpa and appended an editorial note to the podcast, acknowledging that the episodes that told Chowdhury's story did not meet our standards for accuracy. The Times also returned the awards and citations it had picked up for Caliphate, including a Peabody Award, one of the highest distinctions in journalism, and permanently removed Kalamachi from the terror beat. But the investigation's findings did not explain how the Times had been duped by a 20-something with time on his hands. Serious red flags early in his story should have given the paper pause. Chowdhury's claims that he had been granted a job as an Islamic State police officer were dubious. He did not speak fluent Arabic and would have had trouble communicating with the local population. As an unskilled newbie in one of the world's most paranoid organizations, he said he had been driven to meet with the Islamic State Secret Service, which was plotting attacks in Europe. His account of fleeing Islamic State territory on a motorbike, somehow avoiding throngs of trigger-happy militants in their checkpoints, was risible and may owe something to the wartime caper, The Great Escape. A simple Google search would have revealed that the method of execution Chowdhury described, stabbing the person through the heart, was extremely rare in Islamic State-occupied Syria and Iraq. The first reports of its use were published in May 2016, 2 years after Chowdhury allegedly left Syria, but only 6 months before he met the team from Caliphate. More than anything else, why in the world would a returning Islamic State terrorist own up to murdering, knowing he'd be very likely prosecuted by the Canadian authorities as a result? Kalamachi was the face of the podcast, and since its unraveling, she has become a lightning rod for criticism, accused of everything from sensationalism to Islamophobia. Kalamachi's reporting record is thick with errors, and she deserves her share of blame for the project's failure. But the real problem, according to five Times journalists I spoke with, is that senior editors ignored numerous warnings about her work before the making of Caliphate. Three Times journalists who covered the Middle East, all of whom asked to speak anonymously so as not to risk their jobs, told me that they and several of their colleagues had raised concerns with senior editors about Kalamachi's methods, beginning with her first stories for the paper in 2014. They were ignored or intimidated into silence. Senior editors doubled down on their narratives that they wanted her to produce, one correspondent told me, and also doubled down on their own decision to make Rukmini a star. Anything that challenged that, they wanted to disregard or discredit. In the aftermath of Caliphate's disgrace, this reporter continued, some of them have owned up to it privately, but not publicly. The Times has not been transparent. From the start, according to the Times reporters I spoke to, Calamacci was encouraged to write blockbuster stories without any of the institutional checks that should have gone with the brief. The New York Times did not respond to a request for comment. February 2014, the month of Chaudhry's purported trip to Syria, was also the month Rumini Calamacci got poached by the New York Times. Her career was on the way up. A refugee who had fled Romania with her family at the age of 5, educated at Dartmouth and Oxford, Calamacci had flirted with a career as a poet before jumping on a plane to India to cover the 2001 earthquakes. Her reporting was published in Time magazine. She was hired by 2003 by the Associated Press, and several years later, she was appointed its correspondent in West Africa, where she won praise for her work on the exploitation of children. In 2013, she got her hands on internal al-Qaeda documents as the group fled Timbuktu, which yielded new insights into the mundane administration of terror. That story earned Calamacci her second Pulitzer Prize nomination and caught the eye of editors at the Times. She soon joined the team of international correspondents covering Islamic extremism in the Middle East. For a brief period that year, Calamacci and I were on the same beat. She was for the Times, I was for Harper's Magazine and Vanity Fair. We spoke on the phone in August in the wary way that journalists do when they're onto the same story. She was a sharp-elbowed scoop hunter in the sometimes genteel world of foreign correspondence, and I liked her immediately. Riveting page one splashes marked her arrival at the paper. One, published on October 25, 2014, as The Horror Before the Beheadings, described the Islamic State's campaign of kidnapping Western aid workers and journalists. It was a difficult story to report. Most of the three Europeans were reluctant to talk on the record because not all of the hostages had been released, and because their governments and NGOs had shamefacedly paid millions in euros in ransom to the Islamic State. One person who would talk was Marcin Suder, a Polish photojournalist who was abducted from the Syrian town of Sarquahib, and so he became the main character in Calamacci's story. But Suder was clear in his correspondence both with me and with Calamacci that he had no idea who had kidnapped him, and I saw no way it could have been the Islamic State. By the time Suder was abducted, the group had begun to gather all of its Western hostages in a hospital in Aleppo, and none that I spoke to had come across him. Calamacci concedes that Suder never met the other hostages, but she says that was because he escaped before they were transferred to the same location. She confuses the timing of the events in her story. The hostages were held at the hospital in the summer of 2013, not late in 2013, through January 2014, as Calamacci alleges. With few on-the-record sources to work with, Calamacci stretched what she had to suit her purposes. Calamacci's other main character in the piece is a young Belgian jihadi named Jiang Bonatic, who was incarcerated with the journalist James Foley and the photographer John Callentine in an Islamic State jail in Aleppo. Bonatic told Calamacci that Foley, who would later become the first American executed by the group, had converted to Islam while imprisoned, not to curry favor with his captors, but because he was a true believer. Bonatic told me the same story when I interviewed him in Antwerp that September, but there were reasons to be cautious. Botnik had been sent to the journalist's cell, in part to encourage their newfound faith in Islam. He was far from a neutral observer. Another of Calamacci's supported sources, Philip Balboni, the CEO of Foley's employer, Global Post, wrote me recently that he had never confirmed this alleged conversion to Islam. One of Calamacci's sources among the hostages was the French reporter Nicole Hanin, who continues to believe Foley's conversion was genuine, but the only person to whom Foley is known to have spoken directly about his conversion was another French hostage, Didier Francois. According to Francois, Foley said that the conversion was a ruse to get better treatment. After publication, the Foley family complained, saying that Foley was a devout Catholic. They believed his conversion must have been strategic. The Times responded by publishing a meditation on the meaning of conversions in captivity, but an editor's note was not appended to the story until January of this year, following the investigation into Caliphate. The Times acknowledged the conflicting accounts and said that, in retrospect, this original article would have been enhanced if it had reflected more of that complexity. By October 2014, there was already a clear lack of rigor in Calamacci's reporting that ought to have been addressed. 2 months later, Calamacci followed up with another page one story, this time taking aim at the U.S. policy of refusing to pay ransom for American hostages held by the Islamic State. Calamacci's main character was a Syrian cameraman named Louis Abu al-Jod, who had been imprisoned in late 2013, along with 20 Western hostages, in a factory in the Najjar industrial area on the outskirts of Aleppo, where they were relocated from the hospital. Aljo told Calamachi that the American officials he met upon his release in May 2014 were blithely uninterested in what he had to say about the prison's location, making it sound as though the U.S. government had ignored information that might have formed the basis for a rescue mission. But a load emerged from the captivity nearly 6 months after the hostages had been transferred out of Najjar. Calamachi acknowledged the time lag, but finessed it by noting that the Islamic State had been known to recycle prisoner locations. As Calamachi knew, or should have known, the unit of the Islamic State in charge of the Western hostages fled Najjar completely in late December 2013, moving hundreds of kilometers to the east. Omar Al-Ahani, the boyfriend of Kayla Mueller, the American aid worker who was held hostage and likely killed by the Islamic State, told me recently that Al-Jude's account was wrong. Contrary to Al-Jude's testimony, the Americans interviewed anyone they could get their hands on, including Al-Ahani, because they were desperate for actionable intelligence. In fact, a rescue attempt in July 2014 failed precisely because the intelligence was out of date and the hostages had been moved again. Calamachi interviewed Al-Ahani but did not include his perspective in her story. Several foreign correspondents at the Times complained about Calamachi's reckless approach. Ben Smith, the Times media columnist, had reported that Anne Bernard, then the Beirut bureau chief, and C.G. Cheevers, a veteran war reporter, were among the first to raise concerns. To some journalists at the paper, it looked as though Calamachi was crafting the facts to fit the narrative. Her ambition for big stories often seemed to override what should have been a suspicion that she was being sold a line. One journalist who raised concerns with a masthead editor told me that Calamachi was so hungry but not conscientious, she took the bait every time. I began to be convinced that this was a ticking bomb for the Times. But nothing was done. Joseph Kahn and Michael Slackman, deputies of Basket, who was responsible for building Calamachi's early profile at the paper, brushed off the criticism of her work. Calamachi's star power on Twitter was enough to buy her independence from scrutiny and elevate her into a new category of journalists who didn't live by the same rules or standards as everyone else. Again, it wasn't until the demise of Caliphate that an editor's note appeared at the top of her story on the ransom ban. After an article was published, the Times learned that Mr. Al-Houd had given inconsistent accounts of key elements of this episode to Times journalists and others, it read. Some of the problems with Mr. Al-Houd's account came to light shortly after publication, but editors at the time decided not to make any changes in the article. Caliphate was the brainchild of Andy Mills, a young producer who pitched the podcast during his New York Times job interview. His original idea was to create an audio series explaining the rise of the Islamic State, with Calamachi as its center. Miller would go on to become the producer and reporter on Caliphate. Emboldened by the success of The Daily, the paper's morning news podcast, top editors have been casting around for an ambitious long-form audio project. Sam Dolnick, a cousin of the publisher A.G. Schlissberg, an assistant managing editor who oversees multimedia projects, was Caliphate's internal champion. Dolnick approached Calamachi about the idea, and she was enthusiastic. Caliphate had its host, one of the world's most famous terrorism reporters. Now all it needed was a main character. In November 2016, an analyst with the Middle East Media Research Institute called Calamachi about Chowdhury. MEMRI had just published a bulletin profiling Chowdhury's output on social media, where he had been bragging about his time in the Islamic State. Calamachi should have proceeded with caution. MEMRI is a think tank co-founded by a retired Israeli intelligence officer whose work has been accused of sensationalism. The group translates media reports from the Middle East in order to highlight anti-Semitism, conspiracy mongering, and support for terrorism, which otherwise might go unacknowledged. MEMRI has considerable resources at its disposal, and its translations are often useful and insightful, which is why they appear in places such as the Times. But the think tank also risks amplifying the propaganda of fringe extremists without regard to whether their claims are credible or real. MEMRI did not respond to a request for comment. Within a few days, Calamachi and Mills were on the plane to Toronto to meet with Chowdhury. What he told them there became the narrative backbone of Caliphate. In Chapter 3, Chowdhury explains how, moved by the suffering of the Syrian people and inspired by the rise of radical Islam, he ducked under a chain-link fence at the Syrian-Turkish border to enter territory controlled by the Islamic State. By chapter 4, he is shooting a prisoner in the back of the head. In chapter 5, he is called upon to pass judgment on a drug dealer, a rite of passage he had to complete in order to join a battalion called Rayat al-Tawid, in which he had learned about online. Chowdhury told Kalamachi that stabbing the drug dealer through the heart marked his moment of disillusionment, the moment he resolved to quit the Islamic State. The Caliphate reporting team had doubts about Chowdhury's story at least 2 months before the show started airing. Early in 2018, Kalamachi discovered that the stamps in Chowdhury's passport didn't match the timing of his story. According to one TAM staffer who worked on the Caliphate, Kalamachi didn't realize the gravity of the problem until she presented her work to Slackman, who told her to find corroboration. Kalamachi was responsible for fact-checking the whole series, drawing on the paper's expertise but not really beholden to it, sending out tidbits for piecemeal confirmation in a way that didn't get to the heart of the story's fundamental unlikeliness. Kalamachi called some of the paper's best national security correspondents, who dutifully tapped their official sources and found evidence that, yes, Chowdhury was on a terrorist watch list and under investigation by the Canadian authorities as a suspected terrorist. When Kalamachi confronted Chowdhury about his passport, he admitted that he had lied about the timeline of his trip. Instead of entering Syria in February 2014, as he originally claimed, Chowdhury said he traveled to the country after the declaration of the Caliphate, sometime in late 2014 or early 2015. Rather than get to the bottom of things, the Caliphate team simply integrated their doubts into the podcast. It was a fantasy, an illusion created by social media. Reports, officials, and experts were passing around the same information about Chowdhury, which seems to have originated with the MEMRI report on his Facebook and Instagram feeds. More digging would have led them to the truth. By the time the series aired, the Canadian government already had information that suggested Chowdhury's account was utterly bogus, as the Times reporter Mark Mazzetti discovered when he was assigned to investigate the story as part of the paper's review last year. Mazzetti found that Chowdhury had spent huge amounts of time online studying Islamist propaganda. That didn't make him a terrorist. In the months since the Times issued its apology, one cause of the Caliphate fiasco has been entirely overlooked, the role of internet-led reporting. By the time Kalamachi started on the Islamic State beat on 2014, it had become almost impossible to travel through Syria. Bashar al-Assad's government issued a few visas to journalists, and the ones they did supply were often given to sympathetic reporters. And as if an uprising transformed into a civil war, reporting from areas outside government control became fraught with danger. Long before the rise of the Islamic State, rebel groups and Islamist militias had taken to kidnapping Western journalists for ransom. In February 2012, Anthony Shadid, the Times bureau chief, died of an acute asthma attack while reporting from rebel territory in the Northwest. His death, along with that of the Sunday Times reporter Marie Colvin, who was killed 6 days later by government shelling, led editors to think twice about sending journalists to Syria. Since reporting on the ground was so difficult, journalists based in Beirut began cobbling together stories with the help of social media. Reporters such as Kalamachi and myself were plunged into a dangerous new world of online chatter, in which we were outnumbered by highly opinionated activists, analysts, and anti-extremist experts. Hardly any of them had been to Syria since the uprising began. A good many seemed to be getting their information mainly from Twitter. Kalamachi was prolific on social media, chatting with Islamist State sympathizers, retweeting support for her work, and supplying information about her background. Two journalists who knew her at the time told me that she was perennially breaking off conversations and interviews to check WhatsApp and Twitter. Kalamachi's influence with social media was one of her strengths. The rise of the Islamic State was an era-defining story, and Kalamachi was one of the first reporters to take it seriously. Here was a new kind of Islamist, both nimble and hierarchical, and inspiring enough to a small minority of disaffected young Muslims in the West to launch a string of terrorist attacks. The attention Kalamachi paid to jihad social media, where the group was sharing the glossy propaganda that became key to its appeal, gave her an edge on other reporters. But the new reliance on social media led to high-profile errors across the board. Take the case of Ibrahim Kiyosh. According to media reports, Kiyosh was a protest singer from Hama, who had his throat cut and his vocal cords ripped out by government agents in 2011. Almost every major global newspaper and TV station did a story on the killing, and it became one of the defining atrocities of Syrian uprising. This is a purely criminal act, Omar Idlibi, a spokesman for the local coordination committees of Syria, a decentralized network of opposition media outfits, told the Associated Press. They executed him. In a rare interview with Assad in December of that year, Barbara Walters confronted the Syrian president with the story. He seemed to have no idea what she was talking about. I discovered that the facts as presented were all wrong. As I reported for British GQ, the singer was a courageous young man named Fahoud. He was alive and well and living in Europe. I spent several days hanging out at his apartment listening to him sing. Ibrahim Kayosh, on the other hand, was a disabled security guard at a local fire station in Hama, who'd likely been killed by rebels because they suspected he was a low-level snitch for the Assad regime. As far as I know, none of the reporters who filed a story on the killing had been in the country at the time, except for the Times' Anthony Shadid, who interviewed Fahoud in Hama and found out the truth. But Shadid's story got buried in an avalanche of misinformation. Although the Times got that story right, the paper had a share of missteps as it began to rely more on remote reporting like everyone else. 6 weeks after the flurry of stories about Kaush, the Times ran a story informing its readers that the Attorney General of the province had resigned in order to protest the killings and arrest of demonstrators and to denounce the widespread torture occurring in state prisons. As proof of the story's importance, the Times noted that he was the highest official to quit over the brutal crackdown. Opposition media activists released a video of the bespectacled lawman in a neatly pressed gray suit, solemnly reading out for the reasons he had defected. Hundreds of people had been buried in mass graves, he said, and the Syrian army had torn down houses while residents were still inside them. But this is what really happened. El-Bakour had been on his way to work when he was kidnapped by armed rebels who'd been pressuring him to resign and forced him to make several videos under duress. By the time I was able to get in touch with his wife, years later, she had long been a widow. The execution was by bullet, she told me. The family found out about his murder from people in rebel-held villages. It was odd that a man who'd so publicly taken the rebel side should never be heard from again, but the world had moved on, and no one bothered to ask questions. Most of the media are publishing news without any proper investigation, without knowing if it's true or not, said Jihan. It's not important to me. I'm used to these things. Rami Abdulrahman, director of the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and one of the most trusted sources on the conflict, confirmed that the version of the story that had appeared in the papers was 100% bullshit. The stories about Kaush and El-Bakour had a great deal in common. They'd both been filed by reporters in Beirut who had reached out via telephone or social media to opposition activists in Hama, specifically the local coordination committees. The LCC spokesman, who told the Times that El-Bakour was in hiding, went by the name of Omar Idlibi. This, presumably, was the very same Omar Idlibi from the LCC who puffed up the lie about Kaush in an AP interview. A month later, he was excited about the possibilities presented by El-Bakour's defection. He knows every single detail about the crimes committed by the authorities, Idlibi told a reporter from the Times. With the information he had, he assured the reporter, we will be able to take the regime to the International Criminal Court. In 2018, I sent a corrected version of the Abakur story to David McCraw, a lawyer for the Times to whom some family members of Islamic State hostages had complained in 2014 about Kalamachi's reporting. He agreed it was worth revisiting, but the paper wasn't interested in running my reporting. I received an email from the Times magazine editor saying the story was no longer topical. Reporting online, it's hard to know whom you're dealing with. Kalamachi's most celebrated article in 2015 was another page one feature called ISIS and the Lonely Young American Woman, which told the story of a troubled woman in Washington State named Alex, who had fallen under the sways of Islamist online. But there was something unsettling about the article. Despite some deft narrative footwork, there was no real evidence that Alex had ever been in touch with anyone from the Islamic State. Alex had communicated with someone on Twitter who said he was fighting for the Islamic State in Syria, but that could not be confirmed. For the most part, Alex's new online friends were a combination of Salafis and Islamic State fanboys. Kalamachi identified one Twitter account Alex had communicated with as having been in regular contact with ISIS fighters, but just as in Caliphate, this was one of so many say-sos of MEMRI rather than her own reporting. The article was careful to acknowledge that the Islamic State's recruitment effort is vastly extended by larger rings of sympathetic volunteers and fans who pass on its messages and viewpoints. But in doing so, it muddied the distinction between online state sympathizers with no formal connection to the organization and the group itself, the same approach that would prove Kalamachi's undoing and caliphate. Mubin Sheikh, an anti-radicalization expert, came across Alex online around the same time. Alex suffered from complications relating to fetal alcohol syndrome, and Sheikh told me was spending around 18 hours a day on the internet. When I asked if the people she met there might have been sympathizers rather than militants, he agreed it was possible. Sometimes, he noted, it's difficult to tell the difference. Announcing the results of the paper's internal investigation in December, Bask admitted that Caliphate had been an institutional failure that went beyond any single reporter. They had treated the podcast like a story in the daily paper, relying on the reporter to check her own work, instead of like a major magazine feature or investigation, which are more carefully vetted. I did not provide the kind of scrutiny, nor did my top deputies with deep experience in examining investigative reporting, he told the staff. By the time problems reached the desks of high-ranking editors, the project had momentum, and it was allowed to move forward despite them. Kalamachi was a powerful reporter whom we imbued with a great deal of power and authority, Vasquez said in an NPR interview the same day. She was regarded at that moment, as you know, as big a deal ISIS reporter as there was in the world, and there's no question that that was one of the driving forces of the story. Internally, the apology only intensified the disappointment many felt with the paper's leadership. In the days before the public recantation, Khan called a number of reporters who had previously raised concerns about Kalamachi's work. His tone was apologetic. He and Dolmick then convened a video call with a group of between 15 and 20 reporters and editors to discuss the findings. The mood was funereal. The Times had worked hard to build up expertise in the region, someone pointed out, which editors then proceeded to ignore. The result had been to undermine the collegiality and openness that characterizes good editorial decision-making. According to Eric Wemple, a columnist at the Washington Post, Cheevers wrote a statement he had prepared that excoriated top editors for ignoring and maligning those who had raised red flags. Warnings were not just dead letters, he said. They became a basis to impugn people's They became a basis to impugn people personally and professionally. One journalist invoked the spirit of Anthony Shadid. Khan seemed chastised. Kalamachi was reassigned to cover education, and an experienced editor, Cliff Levi, was brought in to oversee the audio department, but the imbroglio seemed to call for a broader reckoning. The Times, already divided over controversial resignations, such as that of editorial page editor James Bennett, was struggling to hold its newsroom together. Staffers and readers started to complain that Kalamachi had been the only person to be penalized. Accusations of inappropriate workplace behavior by Mills in a previous job, detailed in a 2018 article in The Cut, began to resurface online. In February, he resigned. I spoke to him shortly thereafter, and he told me that the Times' reinvestigation of Caliphate found no journalistic malpractice on the part of the audio team. Kalamachi and Mills had brought all their findings to Dolnick, Slackman, and Matt Purdy, who headed investigations, and they had signed off. In a meeting during the internal review, Bask had told Mills, "I won't let you blame yourself." Nevertheless, no one outside the Caliphate team had faced consequences. Dolnick, as the executive in charge of audio and a major force behind Caliphate, clearly failed to provide the necessary editorial oversight, but the fact that he is a Susburg heir may have shielded him from scrutiny. The focus stayed on Kalamachi. This is a pattern the Times has repeated. The paper system for anointing certain journalists as stars has long been the cause of controversy. Judith Miller's celebrity status at the paper was one of the explanations given for her dramatic rise and fall following her credulous report about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Kalamachi came aboard at the beginning of an era in which journalists were becoming brands on social media. Thrown into reporting from afar on a region she knew little about, she foundered, but senior editors at the paper were too pleased with the results to care. A succession of senior editors, Khan, Slackman, and Dolnick among them, were happy to nudge her toward blockbuster, character-driven pieces, culminating in Caliphate. The pressure was to produce and produce, even at the expense of spreading the reporting thin. Everything in this story leads to the internet because that's where it all began, said one caliphate staffer. It plays a key role in kingmaking, which is at the root of the problem that the Times is now dealing with. The incentives of the internet mean that the Times keeps wanting to do this. Syria might have been considered an outlier. The war was such a dangerous and expensive conflict to cover that it became too difficult to put journalists on the ground. But the murkiness of its information wars seems, in retrospect, like a rehearsal for many of our current concerns about fake news. We often talk about disinformation as a strategy used by antagonists, Russians, the alt-right, Donald Trump, who deliberately seed lies and conspiracy theories. But the truth is that bad information is everywhere. As foreign bureaus become a thing of the past, there are fewer reporters on the ground. Journalism is supposed to be a labor-intensive business, one that requires digging up facts. Today, there is a glut of information out there for free, but most of it is put there for a reason. The New York Times reporting on Syria is better than most, probably the best there is, and the paper gets things right far more often than it gets them wrong. But strong journalism requires on-the-ground expertise and skepticism as much as great character and slick narratives. The alternative is a new age of ignorance in which media companies offer their platforms to anyone with an axe to grind. While awaiting trial for allegedly perpetrating a terrorist hoax, Chaudhry is helping out his family in their restaurant. On New Year's Eve, I sent him a WhatsApp message asking whether he'd like to talk. "I didn't lie about anything," he wrote back. "The fact is I won. I got away with jihad. And now everyone is trying to save their ass, including Canada." Calamacci still thinks there's a chance he's telling the truth, believing that the hoax charge could be a complicated play by the Canadian authorities to force him to admit his crimes. The pair apparently remain in touch. Memoir, The Silent Type by Sam Sussman, on possibly being Bob Dylan's son. In 1974, my mother was 20 years old, trying to make it as a theater actress in New York after dropping out of Bennington College. She was in a painting class led by the eccentric Ukrainian-Jewish artist Norman Rabin, the youngest child of Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem. One day, Bob Dylan showed up unannounced. They were painting abstracts at the time, and when it was my mother's turn to comment on Dylan's work, she just shrugged. At first, that was the sum of their relationship, her quiet refusal to adulate Dylan's celebrity. One evening, after a particularly long session, Dylan abruptly asked my mother whether she wouldn't mind hosting a party. It didn't make much sense. She's living on a third-floor walk-up in the East 70s. He was Bob Dylan. He came to her apartment in red cowboy boots. People drank and chatted and left around 2 a.m. Dylan closed the door behind the last guest with a flick of his boot and turned to face my mother. So began a year of what she would later politely refer to as dating. In the East 70s walk-up, they painted and read poetry and talked very little about the fact that he was married. He often called at odd hours to play the music he was assembling onto what would become Blood on the Tracks. Once she read him Petrarch while they smoked, which was the only time she seemed to have made it into his lyrics. Eventually, the relationship lost its allure. She must have known there were other women. It's now a matter of record that Dylan tangled up with those days with Ellen Bernstein, a 24-year-old employee of Columbia Records, and the actress Ruth Tyangel. My mother never told him things that were over. She just changed her phone number and stopped responding to his letters. In the years that followed, she left acting and started a business, married my father, passed the lease on the walk-up to a young sibling, and relocated to rural Orange County, New York. I was born in January 1991 in a farmhouse near Goshen, a bucolic town protected by slumbering hills and apple orchards 60 miles northwest of New York City. My parents divorced when I was 2. I lived with my mother and sister in a world as different as could be from the city she had left behind. We chopped firewood and picked blackberries and wore sweaters my mother knit out of yarn spun from the wool of our sheep. My mother loved stories. When I was a child, she read to me about King Arthur, Robin Hood, and Harry Potter, her voice changing tone and temperament as the characters danced around our kitchen table. I remembered Willy Wonka leading Charlie through the chocolate factory, my mother's voice almost singing his lines, and the merry men defying the Sheriff of Nottingham. She had a stunning English accent she used only for Robin Hood. When my sister and I were young, my mother became interested in holistic health and slowly built her own practice. She saw through conventional shortcuts, fad diets over medication, and drew on her training in psychology, meditation, homeopathy, and kinesiology to help others develop a more intentional relationship with their health. She came to believe that mental, spiritual, and physical well-being are interwoven, that negative relationships to food, self, and other people are often cyclical. What she cherished most in her work was hearing her patients talk about their lives. For all my mother's love of stories, she resisted sharing her Dylan chronicles. The episode came to me in pieces, always reluctantly, an old friend reminiscing, a stranger prying. My mother told anecdotes the way she held a yoga pose, the way she practiced holistic medicine, with attention to each detail, strength radiating from her core. She felt that nothing cheated narrative of its elegance more than swagger, excess, or hyperbole. Perhaps this is why she rarely talked about Dylan. The affair too easily made too much of itself. By the time I was a teenager, I had begun to wonder whether there was another reason my mother preferred not to talk about the man. It seemed that every adult in my life, teachers, coaches, strangers, wanted me to know how uncannily similar to Bob Dylan I looked. I cut my hair, and the comments continued. I let it grow long, and I was told I resembled him even more. A teacher once emailed me in the middle of the night to say he was watching a documentary about Dylan and could not stop thinking about how much I looked like him. I was raised on tales of princes mistaken for paupers and muggles revealed to be wizards. What sort of reader would I have been had I not wondered whether my claim to Dylan ran deeper than second-hand acquaintance? Admittedly, this reverie was born in part from unhappy facts. My father remarried when I was 8, and I struggled to feel welcome in his new family. I admired his work as a civil rights lawyer and loved to talk to him about baseball and politics, but I didn't always feel secure in my relationship with him. Meanwhile, my mother's romantic life introduced me to a range of alternative father figures. Some men stayed years, others only hours. One stopped returning my mother's calls after I lambasted him for being a Red Sox fan. My favorite was Rusty, the only one she married, a born-again Christian with 2 sons my age. We put up a second basketball hoop at the far end of the driveway and spent countless hours evenings playing 2-on-2. He and my mother divorced when I was 12. So I entered my teenage years with the usual maladies of a boy who reads too much and lives inside his own head, my awkwardness compounded by familial dislocation. It wasn't the warmest time between my mother and me. I missed my stepfather while she wanted to distance herself from him. The only candid conversations we had were on drives home from the therapy sessions I'd begun with a local counselor who, under the cover of his suburban father effect, tried to determine just how fucked my inner life was. On one of these drives, my mother mentioned Dylan unprovoked for the first and only time. The headphones that were semi-permanently clapped over my ears must have hinted that I was listening to Blonde on Blonde, and she would have been desperate to find common ground. It's the first time I remember hearing the story in one piece. The painting class, the party, the red cowboy boots, the midnight phone calls, the silent breakup. When she finished, I asked what I thought was an innocent question. Did you ever see him again? She said she had. In the spring of 1990, her sister received a phone call from a man asking for my mother. The caller said Bob Dylan wanted to talk to her. My aunt later confirmed this call to me, though she couldn't say why Dylan's overture had run through her. After receiving Dylan's message, my mother made plans to meet him at the old apartment. Dylan arrived in his red cowboy boots, whether out of habit or nostalgia, she doesn't know. As I registered the date, roughly 9 months before my birth, my mother went silent. The car swept through the black winter night. Was this half-story an admission, or was my mother gifting me Dylan as an imaginary father to compensate for the difficulties in my actual paternal relationships? Had she started with benign intentions, then realized the story's danger, mid-sentence and decided not to finish? A stranger thought, since she had been with my father at the time of the reunion with Dylan, was it possible that she herself didn't know which man was my father? After shock came elation. What more satisfying validation could there be for a shy Jewish vegetarian, bullied teenager, than a secret lineage from one of the greatest bards of our age? Dylan was the rare celebrity I could identify with, a Jew fluent in the tradition but rooted in rural America, a storyteller as unbridled by form as every young writer wants to be, a defiant political voice resistant to sloganeering, a freewheeler moving between cultures at his own chosen speed. I was raised in this country. I've been working in this town, Dylan sings in Mississippi. I've been in trouble ever since I set my suitcase down. When I read in Chronicles, Volume 1, that Dylan told Columbia Records he had come to New York on a freight train, I knew that if I ever made it to Manhattan, I'd claim the same damn thing. There were worse people whose secret child I might be. In those days, I read everything I could about Dylan, and I soon discovered the maze of his private life, the secret marriages and unaccounted for children. Could these conspiring facts, Dylan's... profligacy, the 1990 reunion, our canny resemblance really be a coincidence? And if there were others, all the better. I had plenty of practice with half and step siblings. I would fit in just fine with the motley crew of secret Dylan offspring, this club of father-hungry poets drawn together by the exclusive invitation of the accidents of our birth. But perhaps more than seeking a literal father, I looked to Dylan for evidence that I could make it as a writer. Besides my mother and my 10th grade literature teacher, nobody had ever given me a reason to believe I could. More than one high school teacher accused me of plagiarism when I used a four-syllable word. I was from an apple country nobody had ever heard of. If Dylan didn't kosher my creative aspiration, I felt certain nobody else would. I imagined him reading my work and responding with a single aphorism that I would spend years deciphering. I knew that Dylan never commented on his own writing, but surely in the throes of a father-son reunion, he would offer at least a sentence of commentary on mine. Still, Dylan remained unspoken between my mother and me, even as we grew closer. In the first 2 years after I left college, she went through a difficult breakup and a bout with breast cancer, and something shifted in our relationship. We started talking regularly on the phone. I would sometimes take the bus to meet her in New York to watch theater performances. We went to see Fun Home and Natasha, and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, and staging of my favorite novel, Chaim Potok's My Name is Asher Lev. After each show, we would have dinner and laugh about her dating life. It helped that I no longer had to see her love interests as potential father figures. In our burgeoning adult relationship, I met a woman who spoke with as much ease about fate and free will as she did about gardening, who wondered if, in asking a question, always exceeded her certainty in any particular answer. She was a woman as knowledgeable as anyone I knew about health and music, painting and animals, literature and tea. A confidant who challenged me to become the best version of myself without imposing her own vision of what that might be. A yogi who stood on her head each morning before the sun rose. She was the reader I trusted most with my first drafts. The only topic we avoided was Dylan. The summer after my second year of college, I saw that Dylan was playing a concert at Bethel Woods, an hour west of Goshen. My mother agreed to go on one condition. I was not to try to draw his attention to her. It was a humid night. We sat a dozen rows from the stage. The fourth song Dylan sang was Tangled Up in Blue. As always, he altered lines and vanished stanzas. When he came to hers, every word was there. She lit a burner on the stove, Dylan wheezed, and offered me a pipe. My mother began to laugh. As he sang on, she laughed more freely, and by the last stanza, her laughter had turned to tears. My mother was crying, and I was crying with her, and we were weeping and holding each other. People were gawking at us, mother and son gone mad. Dylan was just 50 feet away, singing his infamously mutilated songs, which in the intervening decades must have become about almost anything other than the young actress in the East 70 walk-up, and that my mother was weeping in affirmation of a life that had nothing to do with his. A decade later, and 3 years after her death, this remains one of my most precious memories. We drove home along the winding back roads. I was still high off the music, thinking of all the strangers who had told me I looked like Dylan, and my mother's tears, and the final meeting 9 months before my birth. I heard myself ask what had happened the last time she saw him in New York, whether there was a chance my resemblance to Dylan was no coincidence. Her hands tightened on the steering wheel. For the first time in all our talks on the subject, I sensed from her something more than reticence. The ambiguity of whether I was Dylan's child was so much less important than the certainty that I was hers. I hadn't seen that, and she was hurt. We drove the rest of the way in silence. In the years after the concert, as I left college and tried to find my way as a novelist, Dylan was never far behind. I taught Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall in poetry seminars and quoted my favorite line of his noble speech to my students. In my best memory of writing in grad school, Series of Dreams is playing in the background as night turns to day. I murmured my favorite lyrics all through Connor McPherson's Girl from the North Country when it played at the Old Vic. I had degrees from Swarthmore and Oxford, but I still felt like that kid from the North Country rambling out of the Wild West till I come to into New York town. Once on a country crossroad trip, I met a woman from Dylan's hometown of Hingburg, Minnesota. She seemed about his age, and I asked whether she had known him growing up. She said yes, but there wasn't more to say about his early life beyond what he'd written in Chronicles. We were silent, and then she looked at the light blue skies over the Badlands, and said, that just before Dylan left home, she saw him at the country fair kissing a girl who had long scrawls of hair and hickeys on her porcelain neck. The woman said she had thought little of the encounter at the time, two local teenagers in love, but that as Dylan's fame grew, she often wondered whether he longed for that innocence, if the nostalgia of girl from North Country spoke to the displacement Dylan felt, that certainty he would never again be with a woman he could trust. I thought of my mother's indifference to him in Rabin's painting classes. I wondered whether this is what he was drawn, what had drawn him to her, whether even at 20, so long before my mother became the woman I knew, she had already developed the authentic sense of self that would shape her life. In the months after my mother's death, I knew it was time to relinquish the Dylan reverie for good. My writing wasn't anything like his. How could it be? And while strangers still occasionally told me I resembled him, this had become less routine. And for all my difficulties with my father, many of our conversations about baseball and politics were winding their way into my first novel. My writing was starting to find its place in the world. It did not need Dylan to kosher it. Last year, I received a call from my uncle, who was leaving New York to escape the pandemic. He invited me to move into the walk-up at East 78th Street, which had been passed around my family for 5 decades. I'm writing now in that apartment with the same hardwood floors and likely the same burner on the stove. In the evenings, when the heat pipes just cough, I sometimes think of smoke and poetry that once lingered between Dylan's lips and my mother's. But on nights when I reach for creative guidance, I think not of Dylan, but of my mother, her belief in the integrity of any story told on its own terms, whether it's the tale of King Arthur she read to me as a child or the stories I'm trying to write today. When I look at words disordered on the page, I'm never sure how being Bob Dylan's child would help me come closer to beauty or truth. But I know the infinite gifts of being my mother's son.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me, and I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can't see. If I could read your mind, love, what a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind the drugstores sell. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me. The hero often fails. You won't read that book again because the ending just too hard to take. I'd walk away like a movie star who gets burned in a three-way script. Enter number two, a movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, love, let's be real. I never thought I could act this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's gone. If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong with chains upon